Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Judy, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My God, the enthusiasm here is wonderful. It is just wonderful. I like to see people who enjoy being sober. My sobriety date, because I understand that's how y'all do it, my sobriety date is December the 18th, 1972. Yeah. And you're right, I was 5 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very young when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 23 years old when I came to AA, and so I've had 30 years of sobriety and 30 years of a good life and 30 years of a sober life, and I am grateful for every day of it, although a lot of those days I didn't act like I was grateful for it, because I was one of those alcoholics who didn't come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and immediately fell in love with AA and with sobriety and with the whole deal here. But I'm fortunate that I got here when I did. I want to thank the committee for getting me here. I want to thank my friend and sponsoree of how many years? A long time. Mary Ellen, for coming with me. And because I love to do this to her, because it puts her on the spot. Mary Ellen, would you stand up and let everybody see your pretty face? There are a lot of joys to being sober, and this young lady has been one of mine. And so I'm glad that she's willing to travel with me, and we always have fun. You know, that's great. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. I don't change from that format. That's what the book tells me I'm supposed to do, and that's what I do. I am not a professional speaker. I don't do this for a profession. I'm really kind of a nobody, you know. I just really am kind of a nobody. I don't do anything real special in life. This is a gift that God has blessed me with. I believe that. And that's what it is. It is a gift. It does not make me any better than, any smarter than. I don't do AA better than anybody else. It's just that I'm able to get in front of a crowd of people and talk. And that is a gift from God. So please do not put me on some kind of pedestal like I am here to teach, because I am not a teacher. I am sharing with you my experience, strength, and hope. My personal goal today is to take away from you every excuse you ever had for drinking. That is my personal goal. Okay. Now, I personally believe that if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't ever have to drink again. Okay? Thank you. I understand about relapse, although when I got sober, we called it getting drunk, but I understand about that. And if you want to call it relapse or whatever you want to call it, that's fine. You know, a duck is still a duck, right? But my point is that, and it's gotten so bad in some groups, people, and I don't find this funny, that I had somebody ask me one time, when is she supposed to go back out? All right? And that isn't funny. Okay? And I am not putting down anybody, believe me, who has not had it, who didn't get sober right away like I did. I'm not putting you down for that. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not saying that's wrong. If anything, I'm talking to those of us who have been sober since we first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It is our responsibility to let the new ones know when they come in here, they do not have to go back out to drinking. Okay? I know I said at a meeting one night, there was a guy, and everybody that had talked about coming back in and picking up another chip, and coming back in, picking up another chip. And it came my turn to talk, and I said, well, I have never picked up another chip. And some guy in the background said, well, aren't you something? And I said, yes, actually, I am. You know? I mean, if you can come in and talk about how many times you've gone out, I can come in and talk about how many times I haven't. It's just fair. And besides that, you know, what really bothers me is that we are losing a lot of wonderful people who could be wonderful members of Alcoholics Anonymous if they just quit screwing around. Just by God, get sober. You know, get sober. Learn to the kind of life that those of us who have stayed sober learned. Know what it's like to get up in the morning and look in the mirror and like who's looking back. Stay sober long enough to get that feeling. You know, that to me is what's so very important. You know, even to this day, I quit smoking 6 years ago, right? Thank you. But, and I loved them, honey. Let me tell you, if they come up with a safe one tomorrow, I'll go out and buy 4 cartons. So help me, I will. I just loved them. But I just couldn't do it anymore, you know. But I quit smoking, and it's been about 10 pounds a year since then. But still, because of what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, you know, I can get up in the morning and get dressed and put on the face and do the hair and look in the mirror and say, hey, you don't look bad for a fat girl. You know, it's just that kind of thing. Let me tell you how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came from an alcoholic home. My stepfather was an alcoholic. Came into our lives. Of course, he was not an alcoholic when he came into our lives. He was just a heavy drinker then. And I got to be able to watch that whole thing that happens in alcoholism. I came from those homes that some of us still talk about, a lot of us don't want to talk about, but it's part of an active alcoholic home. And I came from one of those homes where people got beat up a lot. I, as the oldest of 3 girls, got slapped around a lot. I had a mouth on me even when I was a young kid and didn't take a whole lot of anything off anybody, even as a child. And as I grew up, that got worse, and being raised by an alcoholic parent didn't help that, didn't enhance that at all. I had been slapped around a good bit, probably till about the time I was 14 or 15, and had my nose broken once, and I had more cut lips than any one human being should have in a lifetime, let alone a childhood. You know, a couple of cracked ribs. And I remember when I was about 14 years old, I decided I didn't need to put up with that anymore, and I started fighting back. And hence was my second addiction, which was fighting. I loved a good fight. I really did. And was a good release for me. And for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really had a hard time learning how to control anger and what to do with anger and what you could do that was positive with anger, because the way I drank and where I lived, if you disagreed with somebody, you just slapped them. There wasn't any talking anything out. You know, if there was an argument and you fought, and the one that was still standing was the one that was right, and that's kind of the way it worked. Along with the physical abuse and, of course, verbal abuse, you know that goes along with it. It always does. They don't hit you with their fist to tell you you're a sweet kid. So along with that, there was a sexual abuse, and that started when I was 9 years old, and that went on until I was like 16, and that's just part of my story. And again, I don't tell you this because I want you to feel sorry for me or anything else. This is just the way that it was. And it also, I am telling you this because I have a goal to reach here, and that is to take away every excuse you got for drinking. Okay. Now, let me tell you, sexual abuse is a horrible thing. I could get slapped 50 times, man, but it never hurts after the first punch. But the sexual abuse is horrible as a child. It is just something, it's unbelievable what your little mind goes through in trying to deal with that, you know. It's unbelievable. But I will tell you that I didn't have any choice about him taking my childhood from me. I didn't have any choice in that. I've got a lot of choices whether he gets my adulthood or not. Okay. So get rid of that, because that's not a good excuse for drinking, okay? And I don't care if you do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care if you go to outside sources. I don't care if you go into therapy. Do something about it and get on with life, because life has too much to offer for you to sit there and whine and cry about what happened to you as a kid, okay? And especially a sober life as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is too much here, baby. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. Took my first drink. Oh, I was going to let whoever that was answer it. I took my first drink at the age of 10. I absolutely loved alcohol. You all need to know that. I loved alcohol. I was not one of those alcoholics who had to train herself to drink. I loved everything about the drug alcohol. I am grateful. I didn't take anything else, people. I didn't take any drugs at all. Alcohol was my drug. I remember one time I was running with some people, and they offered me a couple of pills and said, "Here, Judy, this will make you feel better." And I was hungover, and I was really feeling bad, and we still had a couple miles to go before I got to the liquor store. So I took them, and I waited for like 10 minutes, man, and nothing happened. And I thought, forget it. I ain't messing with this stuff. You know, I want relief right this second. And you know something? Even if I didn't get high off of that drug, just knowing that I had the bottle in my hand, knowing that there would be some peace down the road was enough for me, was enough for me. Now, I made it through high school, and sometimes I still wonder about that, how I managed to do that. And I got out of high school, and I got a nice little job in a nice little place like you're supposed to. I was doing those things you were supposed to do. I was working in retail. I was 18 years old and moving onward and upward, you know. And I was a good worker. Still, I'm a good worker. A lot of alcoholics are good workers. No, but as I got promoted and I started moving up that scale, people were starting to talk to me about my drinking. My mother was talking to me about my drinking. And I began to work even harder, you see, so that I could prove them wrong. So that I could say, you know, do you really think that they would promote somebody who had a drinking problem? And I found as I did inventories and looked over my behavior in those years that I always did something positive to show them. I didn't do something positive for the sake of doing something positive. It was to show them. I was not a drinker who drank to get happy. I was not a drinker who drank because I was sad. I just drank, man. I just drank. I wanted out. And that's where drinking took me. That's where it took me. I didn't care if you cared about me or didn't care about me. I just wanted to check out. I didn't like anything that was going on. I was a child of the 60s. I'm sorry if you weren't. I didn't like anything that was going on then. I didn't like the war, and I didn't like the way the guys were being treated when they got back. Whether I supported that war or not, I supported the guys in the fact that that's what they wanted to do. That's what they felt compelled to do. And, man, I just didn't like all that. You know, I didn't like the race riots in our streets. I didn't like all that crap going on. I didn't like it, and I couldn't cope with it. Not only what was going on at home with my stepfather, but I just couldn't cope with life. And drinking got me out of all that, you know, and that's what I wanted. As of course, you know what's going to happen because you can't continue. And I was an everyday drinker. A friend of mine in Ohio, Don Smith, describes it the best of any. I was a daily drinker who went on binges, and that's pretty much what it was. You know? I wasn't knee-walking drunk all the time, but, you know, I never lost that buzz, man. Never, ever lost it. I always had a little something going on. And as things went on and the drinking got worse, I let go of the retail and I started doing things like I went to work as a cocktail waitress, which is probably why I got to AA at 23, right? And I worked inside. I started off in one of the nicest bars in the city of Atlanta. I did most of my drinking in Atlanta, a wonderful town to drink in. And I went into these bars and I worked as a cocktail waitress. And then I got into another addiction. I really had three addictions when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one, of course, was booze, and the other was fighting, and my third was men, and not necessarily in that order. And I had a hard time with that. I started falling in love a lot, and two, three times a week, anyhow. And I was one of those women, and I'm sure we don't have any here because we only have them in Georgia, But I was one of those women that would go into a bar actually looking to pick a man up. Can you believe it? And I would do those things. I had a little apartment in Buckhead there in Atlanta. And I'd pick a guy up and I'd bring him home. And, you know, looking back, I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I just didn't know. That was a dangerous way to live. Because I was not always in the nicest of bars. You know, God only knows what I brought home with me. I just don't know, you know. And for those of you who have lived this kind of life, you know, sometimes you bring them home and you go to bed and maybe they stay for the night. And most often they don't. They're gone. I know. And sometimes the night didn't go as well as you had planned and you end up and your furniture's torn up and coffee table's tipped over and there's beer bottles and cigarette butts all over the floor and you're thinking, man, what happened again last night? And you just kind of remember bits and pieces of that, you know, and you're not real sure what went on. And Then there's those mornings you get up and you're just hurt. Everything hurts. And you know one more time you got into a fight and you look in the mirror and you say, I hope to God I won. Because if I lost, somebody's dead. It just, you know. And you go through all that and you know, I'd have those mornings and I'd look in that mirror and I'd say, man, I don't want to be here. You know, I'm not going to do this again. I don't want to live like this. This isn't the right way to live. And despite the fact that my stepfather was an alcoholic, my family was not totally morally bankrupt. I mean, I knew principles. I knew right from wrong. I knew those things to do. You know, I had a Polish grandmother that put the fear of God in you if you'd never been to church. You know, I knew those things. I knew how to behave. And I knew I wasn't living right. And I submit to all of you that every one of us knew that too. Okay? We might have been alcoholic, but we aren't stupid. All right, we know right from wrong, and therein lies our problem. Therein lies the problem, you say. And I'd get up those mornings, and those would be the mornings I couldn't stand to look at myself in the mirror. Those would be the mornings that it was so difficult, and I couldn't even get up and report to work at 4 in the afternoon anymore because I was shaking so bad and so sick that it was difficult for me to make 2 out of 5 days to work. And, of course, I couldn't stay at that place. This was a good house in Atlanta. They paid good money. You know, you made good tips there. And they had to have somebody who was going to show up. And I couldn't show up. You know, and I just did, the more I drank, the further down it went. And I started working in some of those places that are, you know, sawdust on the floor kind of places. You know, my friend Frankie Rice from Georgia used to say that if you didn't have a gun in some of these places, they'd issue you one when you came through the door, you know. And that's kind of the way it was with some of those places. You know, they were rough places. There were a lot of fights. And I mean, we got so bad in this one place that I was working that people be fighting and throwing beer bottles at one another, and the waitresses would just be carrying the tray, dodging them, man, you know, because we knew it was just kind of the way it was going to be on Friday and Saturday night in that bar. That's just the way it was. You know, but then again, pick up some guy and take him home, and the whole thing starts all over again. You know, I tried to straighten up a couple of times and got engaged. I'll tell you what'll cure you of getting engaged. Get engaged to two guys at once. And you know, y'all will understand this. I really wasn't good at making decisions then either, you know? So. And they both had their qualities, really, they did. They both had good points, and I really couldn't quite decide which one was better than the other, so I just kind of held on to both of them for a while. But then, you know, we drink and we forget, don't we? So somehow I had them both coming over for dinner on the same night. And, geez, it still takes the breath out of me just to think of it now. I just... Yeah. So anyhow, there's two guys standing there and I'm fixing spaghetti and meatballs in the kitchen. And I'm real grateful that that kitchen had a back door because I split people. I let them work it out. I just... I just thought, man, we'll deal with this later. I need a drink. I got just so there it goes. I'm grateful, though, really and truly. I am grateful that at one point I did have the opportunity to make amends to one of those fellas after I got sober, and that was a good thing. And they were received very well, thank you. Received very well and very loving And he was a good guy, and I was glad that I was able to make amends to him. The other one left Georgia right after that, and I never saw him or heard from him again. So it goes. I got sicker, and I was doing the things of going to shrinks and going to doctors and going to hospitals and trying to get straightened out what was going on. And I just wasn't getting any better. I did a six-month stretch at a state hospital, and they had me hospitalized, believe it or not, for being suicidal homicidal, which was not totally inaccurate, but... Never was alcoholism mentioned. Isn't that strange? Because, you see, back then I was too young to be an alcoholic. I was a woman, and women don't become alcoholics at 23. And they began to give me excuses for my bad behavior, and my stepfather was one of them. And, that worked out very well if you're still an alcoholic. And I stayed there for 6 months, and then I pulled a con because I was tired of staying there. I hadn't gotten into a fight, but I became threatening to some of the other patients there, and So they put me on Milleril. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Milleril, but it keeps you from being violent. And it's not that you can't throw a punch. It just takes about 3 weeks to get there. It just keeps you stupid, people. It just keeps you stupid. And I hated that stuff. And I didn't like that, and I didn't like the fact that I was on restriction and I couldn't leave the grounds. They wouldn't give me a weekend pass, and I didn't like that. So I just became the best patient they've ever seen. And I went, and I really worked on the shrink's ego, because I knew that he'd be proud if he knew he had cured me, and so I played that for all I could play it for. You know, and I went in, and I told him I hadn't been a real good patient, and I knew I hadn't been a good patient, but I was working real hard to try and develop relationship skills with the other patients, and I appreciated all he was doing for me, and I wondered if I could have a three-hour pass to go home and get my winter clothes, because I'd come in there in the spring, and it was now becoming winter. Well, he was real pleased with my humility and the fact that I was starting to become socially acceptable, and so he gave me a three-hour pass, and that was in 1972, and I'm still out on that three-hour pass. And, you know, I tell that story a lot, and here's why. Every alcoholic in here knew I wasn't going back. You know, we all... Why didn't this guy get it? I don't know, you know? Yeah. And I had a man, and he had two cases of Miller High Life and two quarts of Black Velvet Canadian Blend, and we took off. And I don't remember a whole lot about what happened the next 10 to 14 days, and... I don't know where I was. I have no doubt in my mind what I was doing. My mother and I tried to piece this together, and somewhere between then, 10 to 14 days, I was gone. I was missing. You know, I often talk a lot about what I put my mother through during my drinking, and how selfish we are when we say to ourselves, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, and I don't know, some folks seem to think it's okay just to say, I'm sorry I did that, but see, I don't, I just don't think that's what's intended. I think when, you know, there's an old term, and Bill used it, he called it mending fences. And for those of you who have may not have been involved in country living at all, you may mend a fence, but you may have to go back and mend it later on. You know, you may have to put that barbed wire up one more time 2 years later. You know, it's an ongoing thing is my point. And so is my amends to my mother. And in order for me to feel right about me, what I have had to do is be the best daughter I can be on a daily basis in sobriety. And what that means is I give my mother the time. You know, I am not too busy to talk to my mom. I make time for my mother. No. I listen to the same. She's at that age now where she repeats herself a lot, and I hear the same thing two and three times a week. And that's okay. That is okay. You know, if she wants to tell me the fourth time, that's okay. Because that's my mother. And I put her through a lot. And I owe her the respect and the love that she so freely gave to me. Now, so that's how I work that. And that's, thank you. Thank you. Now, I don't want to tell you truthfully that my mother was sweet all the time, but we'll get into some of that later. I had pretty well, you know, in my drinking, I had pretty well used up and burned up everybody I could use, and I had run out of fiancés, and I'd gotten to the point where men just wouldn't be around me anymore, because I had gotten so dangerous, I never knew. I mean, I was bad with knives, I had this thing with knives, I had this thing with broken bottles. It was just not safe to be around me, you know, so the guys kind of left me alone, and it's in short order, when you don't have men around to kind of help you out every now and then, you know, you run out of money, and I was running out of money, and I was running out of booze. And I was running out of jobs, and so I did the only thing that I knew I could do. I called a guy I had known in the bar and restaurant business, and I went to work as a hooker in Atlanta, because that's all I knew to do. I didn't know what else to do. And I got to share with you here, because it always cracks me up when I say that, and I look out at the audience, you know, because you got a couple folks who think that's disgusting. I was going to talk at it, well, I ended up talking at the place, but I moved to an area that did not know me, and rumor got around that there was an ex-hooker now living in the neighborhood. And that they didn't really think a woman with that background should speak behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you, people, here's what I know to be true, okay? My two worst critics in Alcoholics Anonymous are the guys that had to pay for it or the women who didn't have sense enough to sell it, okay? Get a life. You know, and I'll tell you, really, I am not ashamed of it, because that's what I had to do. If it offends you, that is really your problem. It is really your problem. And I'll be honest with you, because you're such a loving group, I've reached a stage in life where it's a real fond memory, people. It really... You know... You know, what does our book tell us? You know, our darkest past will be our greatest asset. You know, and let me tell you what is so sad. I do that every day. I talk about being a hooker every time I talk. And as long as I've got breath in me, I will. Okay? As long as I'm asked to do this, I will. Because for 6.5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I waited for a woman who had backbone enough to come up here and say she worked as a whore. I got to thinking I was about the only one in AA. You know, and the relief that I felt when she said that, I will never forget. I thought, thank God there's one more. Thank God there's one more. Now, I can tell you personally, I know there's a lot more than two of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, but where do we get off, you know? I mean, please, if you hear nothing else I say to you today, please. Don't ever clean up your story so well you forget where you came from. Please. You see, that is the only saving grace our newcomers have. That's it. And if we come in and we're so clean and we're so dainty and we're so nice and we've never said a bad word except one time, you know, what do they want with us? You know, what are we giving them? We've got to say, honey, I know what it's like to be dirty. I know what it's like to put on a $200 dress and then get so drunk you fall around and crawl around in Georgia red clay in it and get up the next day and say, what happened? I know what that's like. That's what new people not need to hear. That's what they need to hear. You know, it is not in the fine clothes. It's not in the good job. It's not in the big house. It's not in the expensive car. It's in here. And if you haven't got it here, you ain't got it. What we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is an ability to heal. And it's a different kind of healing. It's a healing of the soul. Okay, it's a healing of the soul. And we have to share that. And if you're here for any other purpose than to get well, you know, in here, you're not here for the right purpose. It's an inside job, baby. Drunkenness is an inside job, and so is sobriety. All right? Okay. And I ask any of you, please, who may think that you are superior, how many times did you prostitute yourself? Maybe not the way I did, but how many times did you lie? How many times did you go against everything you knew to be right and true and good to feed your addiction? Okay. So there's a little hooker in all of us, isn't there? I came into work one day and I had red shoes on. And one of the girls that I work with, she said, ooh, Judy, look at them red shoes. And I let that slip. I said, yeah, there's a little hooker in all of us, isn't there? She wore red shoes the next day. No, she didn't either. I'm just kidding. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a couple months thereafter, after this thing with the hospital and all. I had made an attempt at suicide, which, you know, is kind of norm for a lot of us. And I got back from the hospital, and I went to stay with Mom one more time, and I'm a mess. I'm 23. I weigh 85 pounds. I'm kind of yellow because I drink all the time. I don't eat much. And my mother did the kindest thing to me she'd ever done, and that is that she looked me right in the eye and she said, "You pack your bags and you get out. I have had it with you, and I've had it with your behavior, and you are no longer welcome here." And I never thought it would get that bad. But I knew, you know, when Mama throws me out, I knew something was going on. And people, to this day, I can still look in my mind's eye, and I can still see my mother's face as she's standing at her kitchen door telling me to get the hell out. I can still see it. I'll never forget the heartbreak on that woman's face. I will never forget it. No. And at the time I resented her, at the time I was so bitter towards her, at that time I thought, how could you? I am your firstborn daughter. How could you do this to me? Not knowing that was the best thing she could have done. Because then I didn't have anybody else to bail me out. I didn't have anybody else to run to. I didn't have anybody else to put a roof over my head. I was no longer welcome in her home. And I knew that to be true. And I went to stay with a cousin of mine in short order. She was ready to throw me out. 3 weeks I lasted there. And by now we're into December, and I know it's cold, and even in Atlanta, Georgia, the sunny south, it gets cold in December. No, and I didn't want to go back out and try and live in those rat holes that I had lived in before. I couldn't handle it anymore, and somehow I intuitively knew I couldn't handle it anymore. And I asked my cousin if she would please call AA for me. I'd been on a drunk. I was really, really sick. I was really, really shaken. I was all those things that we are when we're coming off a drunk. And I couldn't dial the phone. Back then it was, you know, you stick your finger in and dial a rotary phone. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't because I shook so bad, you know, and I couldn't see numbers. And she called for them, and they came, and they took me to my first AA meeting. And they talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit on the way to the meeting, and I listened when I got to the meeting. And what I heard in AA, as we all do on our first meeting, is the laughter, you know, the laughter of alcoholics. And that rich, true laughter that comes from really deep inside, and it's real, and it's honest. And I noticed how everybody interacted with everybody, and they all seemed to like one another. And for some reason, and I don't know why, it just didn't seem phony to me. It didn't seem like the crap I'd seen around the bar. It just didn't, you know. And I didn't know what y'all had. I didn't know anything about the steps. I didn't know anything about anything, you know. I just knew I didn't want to get drunk anymore. And at the very end of the meeting, the man who had brought me to the meeting, a man and a woman, and 12-stepped me, and the man at the end of the meeting said to me, he said, "Judy, are there any questions? Is there anything you want to know about us?" And I said, "No, I don't have any questions. I just don't want to get drunk anymore. I am sick to death of being drunk." And with everything I had inside of me, I was sick of being drunk. And do you know, today, I'm just as sick of being drunk. It hasn't changed. I am still sick of being drunk. I'm here to tell you people, I don't have any fear of going out and drinking and dying. My fear is going out and drinking and living. Okay? To live to that crap over and over and over again. The waking up in the middle of the night. The seeing the things coming out of the walls. The shakes. The not being able to write a check. Not only because your hand's shaking, but there's no money there. You know? All of that. I don't want any part of that anymore. I don't want any part of that anymore. I was sick of that kind of life. No. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in, and I was going to this group on the north side of Atlanta, a nicer group. Well, let me tell you, I wasn't north side Atlanta material anymore. You know, I just wasn't. I didn't walk like it. I didn't talk like it. I didn't dress like it. I didn't look like it. I looked like a girl who lived on Peachtree and 14th. That's what I looked like. And I didn't fit into that group. And the ladies were kind to me, and they were loving to me. And they said to me, you know, you may want to go to this group on the other side of town. And I'm glad they said that. I took no offense by that then. Take no offense by it now. My mouth was horrible. I had a mouth that was awful. I used such trash language. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how to behave anymore. I just didn't. It's not that I hadn't been schooled. I'd been schooled. I knew how to do that. But, you know, you live the way that you have to live. And when you're living out there and you're fighting that mess, you change those habits. You change the way you talk because you've got to survive, and you know that. So you do what you have to do to survive, and that's what I did. So I didn't know how to behave anymore. You know. So I went to this group, and this group was the Atlanta Biscayne. And I went there when I was 11 days sober. No, and I hadn't been there long, and I fell in love. And that only lasted 3 days. I hadn't broken that habit yet. And I met two guys. One was called Big Jim, very appropriately named. huge guy, just a huge man. Oh, people, for crying out loud. Jesus. He was my sponsor, for God's sake. But Jim just decided that he was going to adopt me. And another guy was named, we called him Dad, and he was a little merchant marine. And I always used to say about Dad, because he had a mean streak in him, that if I ever went back to fighting, I'd want him on my side, you know. He was just that kind of feisty, tough little guy. And these two men decided that they were going to raise me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am grateful, and I do believe that sponsors are a gift from God. And that the right people enter our lives at the right time, or I believe so for these two. Because I couldn't have had two better guys for me. Dad put up with nothing. No whining, nothing. He had an answer for everything, and that's what he didn't feel comfortable and experience sharing. He would send me to somebody else with their permission. Big Jim taught me how to live. Big Jim taught me how to go out and have dinner again and how to behave in public. Big Jim taught me how to be a part of a group, and they were gentle that way. They would ease me into things like this. This particular group did a lot of things outside of the meetings. We would go out to eat. We would have cookouts at one another's home, etc. And I didn't want to do those kind of things because I knew I didn't fit. I knew I didn't belong. I knew I wasn't part of these people, and that if they ever found out what I had done, they were going to throw me out. I knew that. I knew that. You know, so Jim kind of guided me into how to interact with other people. And we'd go out to eat, and I'd be talking too loud or cussing too much, and Jim would give me the look that sponsors give you. They all have it, you know. It's the look. And Jim would give me the look, and I knew I was talking too loud or I was cussing too much, one or the other. You know, it was always that. And then if I wanted to come in and I wanted to whine to Jim, he didn't put up with that. And sponsors didn't put up with a lot of that, you know. When you came in and you started whining about this thing or the other thing or the other thing, they'd say, well, do this step or work this step or read this out of the book. And if you were arrogant like myself and you said, well, I don't want to do that, they'd say, then get drunk. And that was the beginning and the end of the whole conversation. There, you know, if I wanted to talk to him about what was going on, and I'd call him. I never called my sponsors every day. Now, I know a lot of people do that, and I know it works for them, and that's fine. I'm not putting it down. But I didn't call my sponsor every day. And if I did call him and I was whining and something was going on, he'd say, I'll see you at the meeting tonight. And he did. See, my sponsors went to meetings. You know, and he did. And we would talk about it if I still remembered what it was by the time I got to the meeting. And I remember one time I was upset with sobriety. I didn't like the way sobriety was going. I remember going to Jim and saying, because I had no money, you know, I couldn't work. I was so volatile. I was never happy with anything. You know, and I went to Jim one time. I said, let me tell you something, Jim, and y'all, please excuse my language here. I'm just quoting what I said. I'd go out and sell my ass and get out of this mess in a hurry. And he said, yes, Judy, you could. And he said, and I'd still love you for it. He said, I'd still love you. I wouldn't think any less of you if that's what you felt you had to do. But let me ask you one question, baby. Can you stay sober and do that too? Now that took away everything for me. That took away all. There was no excuse for bad behavior anymore. I knew that he would love me no matter what, but that I had to start asking everything in my life, yes, you can, but would you stay sober anyhow? You know, would you stay sober anyhow? What's it going to do to your sobriety? My behavior, I started looking at what my behavior was going to do to my sobriety. You know. Dad had told me one time, I went to him, oh, I know what it was. I was real upset with a gal that was hanging around the room. I just didn't like her. You know how some people, you just don't like them. And I didn't like her, and she was always gossipy. And I came in one day, and I had had it with this woman, and I was going back there to tell her about how displeased I was with her behavior, and Dad saw it coming, and he stopped me in my tracks and said, where are you going? And I proceeded to tell him what I was planning on doing, and he said, get you a cup of coffee and sit down. And back then, sponsors didn't leave those kind of things open for discussion, And as I had told you, I knew Dad was pretty good at fighting, so I opted to go ahead and get a cup of coffee and sit down. And he took that little finger and he put it right in my face and he said, "Now let me tell you something." He said, "You can't live like a drunk and expect to stay sober." And you don't know how many times when my behavior has started to get into high gear, I've heard that line. I can't live like a drunk and expect to stay sober. I can't keep doing the same things that I was doing and expect sobriety. I can't expect it. It's not going to happen. The two lifestyles don't mix. They just don't mix. I got married. I was sober 3 months. I got married. Now listen, really, and y'all can understand this. My motive was good, okay? Because it seemed to me like everybody who had their act together and everybody who was good was married. And I was really shooting, you know, to get at least kind of good anyhow. You know, so I got married and my spouse had 4 months. And we were kind of the source of entertainment for my home group for about 2 years. And we moved up to a very beautiful mountain community up called Hiawassee, Georgia. And, of course, I moved up there and I got like 6 months sobriety. So I'm still wearing and I never was real good about getting a job. I don't know. It just amazes me when I see people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and, boom, they land a $60,000 a year job inside of 3 months, you know. I'm sober 9 months and I can't even make minimum wage or keep a job for more than 2 weeks. I just have too much wrong with me, people, too much wrong. And so anyway, we move up there to Hiawassee, and I'm just not fitting in, and it's very lonely, and it's very tough for me. But what I did do in Alcoholics Anonymous up there is what my sponsors taught me. I took the literature. We didn't have many meetings up there. And I took the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and I read that literature. I read Came to Believe, because Jim had told me, you know, that I had better get in touch with a God, which, by the way, it is in the book, that, you know, your only means of defense will come from a higher power. That is in the book. So I do suggest you get a relationship with God. And I do more than suggest you. I tell you, you need to do that, people. Because your fanny's going to be on the line one day, and it's going to be him that's going to stop you from picking up that drink. No. Yeah. But I took that book, and I was reading that stuff. And I remember my ex-husband and I had a terrible, terrible fight, and I was crying. And I was really crying. I mean, it was real pain. The first real, real, real inside gut pain I had felt. Since I had been sober, and I didn't know if I was going to survive that or not, you know. And so I was sitting there next to that little 8-acre lake there up there in those mountains, and I was crying. And I remember saying, "God, you know, I don't know if you're up there, and I don't know if you can hear me, but I got to have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again." And I didn't want to drink again. You know, I didn't want to be a drunk anymore. And I'll tell you what happened, people, and it was beautiful. It really was beautiful, and I share this every time I talk. Because this is where my relationship with God started. Because the air became so still and so warm and so quiet at just that instant. Just that instant. And it was as though there was a good friend sitting next to me who put his arm around my shoulder and said, "You're going to be okay, Jude. You're going to be okay." And I knew I was. I knew I didn't have to drink. And I have known from that very moment something that I didn't know before. I was a child of God. I knew that then. I didn't know that before. I didn't know. And the marriage did not work out, and I went back to Atlanta, and we were divorced, and I met my husband, Craig. And, well, now, just a minute. Craig and I had known one another even during my first marriage, and don't work anything into that because we didn't do nothing. We had known one another, and we were good friends, and I did not know that Craig had divorced his wife, and so we were kind of at the same place at the same time. We were talking, and it was just kind of one of those things, and about 3 months after my divorce, Craig moved into my place, and about a year and a half later, we were married, and we went about learning how to live in a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my husband, Craig, was a pro football player. He broke his back his third pro game, unfortunately. But I tell you that because he's a big guy. He was just a big man and gentle, a gentle bear, actually, is what he was. And we had started off on this road. And we did those good things, and we did the things that we learned about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Mike Craig and I stay very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Always went to meetings, and he had some real health issues and some real health problems. And there was a year there where he was on full disability, and he had a had a back surgery, and it was very, very difficult. He couldn't work for a year, per the doctors say. We went through a lot of things together. We grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. We started sponsoring people. We did the things that people say are good for you to do and you should do when you start becoming a member of society. You know, we voted. Isn't that cool? That's a responsibility, right? We became part of our community. We went to things like community meetings, okay? We went to a lot of conferences together and taught those in Alcoholics Anonymous that we sponsor that's what you should do. And Craig and I have a belief, and it is that, you know, AA is the center. AA is the center. But I believe that there are other things in life, and, you know, this is hard for me to even say because I don't believe it's happening. I'm a member of a church now. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm the treasurer of my church. I think that's hysterical. Yeah, it's nice that, you know, I go to church now, and my motive for going to church is altogether different. You know, I don't go to church anymore to talk about the hypocrites who go to church. Yeah, you see, I go to church now for one reason: to give thanks to God. That's why I go to church. I don't go to church because I want them to know I'm treasurer. I don't go to church so that I can impress my neighbors of what a good person I am. I go to church to give thanks to God. That's why I go to church. And I think it's okay. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I'm glad that I can do that. And I'm glad that I can do that. And Craig and I became a member of church when we moved to Ohio. We moved to Ohio when I was sober about 20 years. And we lived there close to his family. We had been with my family a long time, and we lived there to be close to his family. And that was nice. That was a good experience for me. And it was a good time for us because we got to be close and get to know one another even better. And we had a good marriage, and that's not to say we didn't have fights. We did have fights. You got two alcoholics. You got two strong wills. You got two people who know all the answers under one roof. Okay? And, you know, it's difficult. It gets difficult. You know, and we worked through it. Craig and I didn't argue a whole lot after our first year. That first year, that poor boy packed his bags so many times, I think they could pack themselves. And that was before I had my temper under control, and I never said anything without throwing something at you while I was saying it, and the mouth still wasn't good, you know. But as we lived up in Ohio, as I said, Craig's health wasn't good, and he had become diabetic, and it was getting tougher for him just to get up and get dressed with the arthritis and that had settled in his spine and just a lot of other problems. And he was constantly getting pneumonia, and we were constantly going to the hospital, and it was getting tough. It was getting tough. When you live with someone who is chronically ill, you don't realize really how much of your life revolves around their illness. Because typically it's just a little at a time. It's not like it's boom, they're real sick real fast. It just goes downhill. And in May of 2000, he had another bout with pneumonia, and we couldn't seem to shake it. And actually, we had gone to the doctor in February, and the doctor told us that the nerve that controls the diaphragm, which controls the breathing, and Craig's spine, because of his injuries, was becoming paralyzed. And that the best that we could hope for was that it would stay the same. It would not worsen. And unfortunately, it didn't stay the same. And May the 21st of 2000, I called the ambulance to come get him because he couldn't breathe on his own. And we took him to the hospital, and they called me from ICU that night about 2 in the morning and said, we're just going to see if we can give him some oxygen and get him a little stronger. And I said, well, do I need to come? She said, no, I think he'll be okay. So I went down there the following morning, and I called Mary Owen's husband, because you just kind of know, you know. And Craig kind of knew too. And we sat in ICU for 7 days. And the doctor came up to me and said, "Mrs. Pierce," he said, I might be able to get your husband out of here this time, but he'll be back in 3 days or less." And he said, "Nothing's working anymore." And he was on life support. And he said, "You need to make a decision." And I pulled on everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me about being spiritual and being strong. Because, you know, you can talk about a living will and you can talk about what you do, but when somebody says, "You need to sign this document so we can turn this off," it's a whole different ballgame, people. And to that afternoon, they turned the equipment off, and Mike Craig went to God at 4:30. And I have missed him every day. Okay. I want to share with you, I'm not angry with God. A lot of people told me it was okay to be angry with God. I'm not angry with God. And I wasn't angry with God. I wasn't angry with Craig. Death is a part of life. You know, it's those things that we have to walk through. And if I learned anything through that experience at all, it was that our God is a loving and merciful God. Because my Craig doesn't hurt anymore. He was a very proud man. It was very difficult for him to ask me to help him put on his socks. It was very hard for him. Mary Helen's husband, Terry, came up and stayed with me the whole time Craig was in ICU. And he was my rock. He did all the mundane things that come up that I needed. You know, I did just everything hits you at once, and it's difficult. No. But I am so grateful, you see, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had 25 years with a wonderful man. Yeah. He would go with me when I was doing these things. And he usually sat a couple rows back. Back when I first started doing this, you could still smoke in conference centers, and my Craig preferred cigars. And I still sometime in my mind's eye can look out and see him sitting there with that cigar, and he'd puff if he really liked what I said. And he was a big man and laid back and never said a whole lot. He was kind of quiet and strong, you know. And I used to get tickled because inevitably somebody would come up to him at the conference and say, "Oh, you are such a good man for marrying a woman like that." And he would just add to the aggravation, you know, because he'd sit there, "Oh, thank you." I used to tell him, "Yeah, like you're some kind of choir boy, right?" You know? It's been a good life, people. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a great life. You know, I have a nice little job today. I'm nobody special, never will be, and that's where I want to be. I don't want to be boss. I don't want to be manager. I want to be back in my little accounting office playing with the numbers. I like doing that. And I'm glad to give myself in love and service where I can to help the company, and certainly will try and do that because that's what y'all taught me to do. I have a little home in a place called Ellijay, Georgia. I have 2 acres of land, and there's a lot of deer out there. I live in the mountains of North Georgia. And I like that. Me and my 3 cats, sometimes 5, sometimes 7. And my 118-pound German Shepherd dog reside on... He's white. He's a beautiful dog. My Buddy. And Buddy and I were out walking in July this past year. And I have a little cat who's just feisty, and her name's Pee Willie. And Pee Willie finds some kind of sick joy in jumping in front of this 118-pound German Shepherd. So I'm out walking this dog because I keep him tied because he is big and he is intimidating and he likes trucks. And out darts little Pee Willie. And Buddy takes me and the leash and goes after Pee Willie. And he went with such a force and a lunge, and any of you who are familiar with those dogs know that all their strength is in their front. And so he has about 400 pounds of pull, And he went to the left, and I didn't go anywhere. And I heard that leg break in my jaw. And before I know it, I'm on the ground. And dog and cat are fine, by the way. And and I don't believe it. I never let go of that dog. I don't know how I held on to that dog, but I never let go of him. And I knew it was broken before I hit the ground, people. There was no sense in me even. I've had broken bones before. I know what it feels like. I know what it sounds like. And if you've ever broken a bone, you hear it right here. Everyone I've ever had broken, you feel in your head. So I'm crawling up to the doghouse because I got to tie the dog back up, right? I mean, my God, if he gets loose, he might kill the cat. Jeez. So the German Shepherd is kind of dragging me, you know, and I'm saying, just be a good boy, buddy, let's get up. And I get him tied up, and I crawl into the house, and I call 911, and it's saving grace is my neighbors are first responders, so they were there in like 2 minutes, because I am out in the country, people. I'm on a dirt road. I mean, I am out there, and they're there in just a couple of minutes. And I, you know, it's funny, the stupid things you think about, you know. I crawled over to the kitchen because I knew it'd be easier for him to get the stretcher in there. The only thing I didn't think about, you know, this is, you laugh at yourself, right? We're kind of crazy. The only thing I didn't think about was I had been working very hard that day around my house. And when I work around my house, I wear a T-shirt and blue jeans, and that's it, man. That's it. Nothing else. And, of course, when you break your leg, they've got to, well. And ladies, you'll understand what I'm saying. Have you ever noticed that ambulance drivers are always good looking? I don't know if it's the uniform or what, but they're just, you know, there I am in love twice in one day, right there. And I remember looking at the cutest one, who's probably 30 years my junior, and I said, God, baby, if I knew you were coming, I'd have shaved my legs. So cute. We really had a good time all the way to the hospital. And I really thought they were just going to do one of those deals where they just set it, put it in a cast, and I'll be fine, right? And the doctor comes over and says, well, you're scheduled for surgery tomorrow morning. Oh, God. So anyway, but Mom came up, and the leg is healed fine. I walk very well. A little bit of pain every now and then, but just one of those humiliating experiences of life. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous and share with you just a little bit of experiences that I think are real important, and then I'm going to sit down and shut up. One of the things that I find when I do this a lot of times is that folks are having a hard time staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So let me share this experience with you. If you're out there and you've got 3 to 5 years of sobriety and you're thinking about killing yourself, you're okay. I want you to know that. I want you to know that, because I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd listened to people up here at the podium, and it just seemed to me, man, like they came in and they got it and I didn't get it. I just couldn't get it, you know. People would be coming in and I'd see them come in and they'd have 3 months sobriety and they got their act together and their family loves them and they don't cuss anymore, and I've got 7 cars and none of them are running and I'm not getting this program. You know, I'm not getting this program. But let me tell you something that's a weird kind of truth for us, okay? If you're sitting out there and you're thinking about suicide, you're getting better because you're not thinking about drinking. All right? You're not thinking about drinking. And for us, that's what's important. And get with another alcoholic. Get with another alcoholic and say, you know, my life's not working. My life is not working. You know, there have been times in Alcoholics Anonymous when I didn't want to hear what you all said. You know, I have not always loved Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been days when I didn't want to hear anything out of the big book. I didn't want to hear. I remember one day I was so angry, I have no idea what, but I was so angry. And somebody came up to me and said, read your big book and go to meetings. Well, thanks for your help, pal. You know, and I told him what he could do with the big book. That was back before I was spiritual, though. And the point of that being, though, truthfully, is that, you know what? What we have here is what we share with one another. For the love of God, come up with something better than just don't drink and go to meetings. If you know somebody in your group is hurting, You know, let's come up. I mean, and share your experience, provided, of course, you have some. Share your experience with these people and share what's going on. That's what we're supposed to do here. That's what we're supposed to do. You know? And open your heart up to them. Remember what it's like to be there. You know? Remember what it's like to feel like you're never going to get your life together. That's an awful feeling. That's a hopeless feeling. And remember to tell them where you came from so they know that no matter where they were back here, someday they too can have that. And that doesn't have to be 15 or 20 years from now. The thing that I have found in sobriety is not that I have lost all my character defects. It's just that they don't rage all the time like they used to. You know, I don't get as depressed as I used to get for as long as I used to get depressed. But I still have days that are not as good as others. I still get angry. But I don't hurt people anymore. Last time I hit somebody, I was 7 years sober. That's 23 years without hitting somebody. You know? We ought to have a chip for that or something. It's not, I don't get it, because I don't think that's what the book meant for us to do. I don't think that the people who founded this program meant for us to go to an AA meeting the rest of our lives. I don't think that's what they meant. As I read my big book, it talks about us being a part of our community. It talks about us fitting back into society. Okay, and I think that means that once in a while we've got to go and do things that other people in society do. We've got to be a parent. We've got to go to PTA meetings. We've got to go to church. We've got to participate in our community. That's what we need to do. Because if anything, we owe them people. They don't owe us. Okay, we owe them. Yeah. So it's good. Life is good. I have a wonderful relationship with my mother today. Great relationship. She comes up and spends a week with me every year during Apple Festival. She likes my front porch. I got a big front porch, you know, and she likes the... Oh, it's empty. Don't worry. She comes up and spends some time with me. I'm going to share with you one of the prettiest things she ever said to me. We were driving one day in Atlanta shopping, and the car was quiet. And out of nowhere, my mother reaches over and she pats me on the shoulder. She says, "You're a good daughter, Judy, and you're a good person, and Mama loves you very much." And that is Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. All of that is Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not Judy. It is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I miss my Craig every day. I miss my Craig every day. I was sharing with Mary Ellen. There are some guys that I know that I've known in the program for years, and they're all afraid of me now because I guess they think I want to get married or something. Which, you know, I am content, and I am truly content, and that's nice. I feel good on the inside, and that's nice. I feel honored that I'm asked to do things like this, you know, because this is not what happens. This is not what happens to women like me. You know, I had three people ask me since I've been sober if I would take their children if something were to happen to them. That does not happen to people like me, okay? That's all Alcoholics Anonymous. I live in an area, and when I go to work in the morning, I go through the North Georgia Mountains, and God, they are a beautiful sight, you know. And every day when I come home from work, and I might be tooling down the road, and I might be thinking about how wonderful I am and all the great things that I've done on that given day, you know, and I come around that one great curve, and all of a sudden there's that big mountain, and God put that mountain right there for me. I know He did. It's right there. And it just soars up into the sky, and I look at that mountain, and I think how little I am, how insignificant I am. You know, when I look at the miracle that He has performed over and over and over again, you know, in my life, in your life, in the lives of those of us at Alcoholics Anonymous, I am grateful that I am but a little piece of that. Just a little piece of that. And I'm grateful y'all are too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.